Well, good evening. My name is Peter Berg. I'm head of special collections here in the MSU libraries, and I would like to welcome you to our 10th fall season for the Michigan Writers Series. The way the readings go is that our guest reads for about 45 minutes from her work, after which I know she'd be happy to take some questions from you if you have any from the audience. And when that's all completed, there are a number of books up here that Stephanie has brought with her that she'd be happy to sell to you and sign as well if you care. So thank you again for showing up. I'm excited that you're here and excited to have Stephanie Mills with us once again. Stephanie Mills has written and spoken on ecology and social change since her college commencement speech in 1969, in which she announced she would not have children due to her concerns about overpopulation and its effect on the environment. Since her emergence in 1969 as an ecological activist, Stephanie Mills has written prolifically, edited numerous periodicals, participated in countless conferences, and served on the boards and advisory committees of dozens of ecologically oriented organizations from the local to the national levels. Her writings include Whatever Happened to Ecology and In Service of the Wild, a book about restoring and re-inhabiting damaged lands. Mills edited In Praise of Nature, a compilation of major works of environment literature, as well as Turning Away from Technology, a New Vision for the 21st Century. Another book, Epicurean Simplicity, addresses the rewards and challenges of a simple life. In her latest book, Tough Little Beauties, Mills examines issues that remain timely today: overpopulation, ecological degradation, the energy crisis, and a life lived spiritually. Stephanie Mills lives in northern Michigan, where she is a freelance author and lecturer. She has been named one of Utney Reader's visionaries. Presently, she is active in a local currency initiative and is writing a biography of Robert Swan, the late founder of the E.F. Schumacher Society. And if you ever have a chance to go to that website, it's really quite impressive. And there are a number of writings by Stephanie on that website about Mr. Swan and his great work. Please join me in welcoming Stephanie Mills back to the MSU campus and to the Michigan Writers Series.
Oh, thank you very much. Thanks, and thank you all for coming tonight. I must thank my friend Eartha, who drove me here. About a month ago, I broke my femur. I was in a bike accident, and so I've been disabled ever since, and it's a learning experience. I'd just as soon do without, but it's taught me, it's taught me about the strength of my community, because Eartha's exceptional, but she's not alone in being willing to lend a helping hand, as we do to one another. And I think that strength of community is something that we'll be needing to build and lean on a lot in years to come. I thought tonight I might start with something from my first book, Whatever Happened to Ecology, which is something of a memoir of my involvement in the ecology movement in the Bay Area in the 70s, and what I learned on my arrival in northern Michigan in 1984, and beginning to become a part of a much different kind of engaged community. And also having the opportunity to be living in a setting where I was completely surrounded by nature, second nature, farmland regenerating. So one July day in 1988, as this work was approaching completion, a desiccating wind blew fiercely for hours, parching the pitiful remnants of green in the field. The grassy swale was drying up like the last watering hole in the veldt. Even the blades at the heart of it were crackling. The hardy mullein was curled crisp. Its flowering this year seemed against all odds. Beyond the reach of the garden sprinkler, the saffron and sulfur hawkweed hurried up their blossoming and cast their seeds to the wind. Only the infernal knapweed seemed to be prospering in the drought, and bare sand was beginning to emerge between them. The illusion of fat was burnt out of the landscape. No more slack. The drought makes graphic the truth that water is the essence of all living bodies on earth. Hydraulic necessity for flowers to turn their pretty faces toward the sun helps leaves to stretch their surfaces taut for maximum solar gain. You can't really grasp the importance of rain until you've seen a maple beech woods looking limp and disconsolate. There hasn't been enough moisture for the wild strawberries to eke out any of their succulent morsels. The first year I came here, there were wild strawberries in such abundance that Rob could gather a quart in a single morning. That's a lot, considering that a wild strawberry is no bigger than a damsel's nipple. We brushed our teeth with wild strawberries that year. This year and last, though, we've received very little rain. Perhaps we don't deserve any. The crops are stunted and withering in the fields. As in the Greek myth, the earth mother, Demeter, is withholding her abundance as lament and punishment for the rape of her daughter Kore in the underworld. That myth resounds today in the crunching of dried lichens underfoot, in the languid pattering of famished grasshoppers scattering with every footfall. This dry desolation is acute for its moral dimension. Some scientists say this may be the first result of the greenhouse effect. All the combustion and deforestation industrial man has been doing has created a denser envelope of carbon dioxide, methane, and chlorofluorocarbons around the planet, which is retaining more of the sun's heat. With help from agribusiness, this climatic change could desertify the farm belt. That searing, windy afternoon, I halfway expected Wisconsin to blow by. Exceeding Earth's capacity, we humans have pushed the ecosystem beyond the margin of forgiveness and are due to reap the whirlwind. Because this bad weather may well be the result of everyday actions like driving and consuming mass-produced goods, especially forest products, I find myself finally feeling responsible, accusatory, guilty, and self-righteous all at once. M. Esther Harding, a Jungian psychologist, suggests that such a global sense of guilt is a function not of personal humility, but of inflation, the arrogance of taking responsibility for a whole civilization's practices. I can relate to that. Most days, I have as little compassion and understanding for the other poor saps participating in this geophysical debacle as I do for myself. So I oscillate continually between blaming self and blaming others. The self-righteousness that stems from knowing, if not doing better, however, is no substitute for an attitude of compassion and detachment. We do not make ourselves, Harding said, and it is hubris to think as though we did. Thinking we should be able to tailor our own makeup to suit our own tastes is like thinking that nature may be improved upon. No one of us, individual, generation, people, or nation, made this ruinous civilization. We humans are impelled to expansionism by our very DNA. So it bespeaks a lot of nerve to take on one's shoulders the weight and to imagine that one could have even a minuscule role in or responsibility for transforming it, rendering it harmless. Yet, paradoxically, we all do, everyone enjoying the fruits of consciousness anyway. That wrestling match has not come to a conclusion in my psyche or that of others. I mean, it is a strange time to be alive when we, you know, can see the planet-wide effects of our collective choices and search hard to find room in which to change our own life ways. And that, you know, that paradox, that conundrum, that embarrassment has really been somewhat my stock in trade as a writer of saying you know, what could usefully be done, what we might do better, how hard it is to change our way of living, but that really is incumbent on us. The next thing I'd like to read is an essay. It's a rare thing. It was for this chapbook that was produced at a conference, a community course titled Live Well, Live Wild, that was held at the University of Iowa. So it's a meditation on wildness and in our time. In our time, the wild is an ever-receding horizon. With every technological intrusion and political economic travesty, it becomes necessary to qualify wildness. We can't control or deny the wildness of vast phenomena like volcanism or the weather. Obscure realms of insects, fungi, and protozoa teem with wildlife. The Earth's rotation is wild. The sun is wild. But in the mesocosm where we live, what's wild is under continual assault. What is wild when two-thirds of the planet's surface has been degraded by human activity? When the rate of extinction is a thousandfold, what is normal? What will wilderness be when the extinction crisis has passed and evolution replenished the earth? One late May evening, I walked into my woods in search of the wild. It's a woodland tatter, not a remnant of what Raymond Dasman, the conservation biologist, called the old wild world. It's my Concord, not my Alaska. For the 20 years that I've lived on this land, I've been going on rambles through the cover of 35 acres of self-willed, albeit exotic, Scotch pines. Prowling, I seek the return of the native, signs of the wildlife, prints in the snow or scuffs in the duff. That particular evening, I wanted to visit a small population of star flowers I'd come upon some years ago. When I found them again, it rejoiced me to see that their numbers had increased. Nobody planted them. The star flower is simply a plant common to the North Woods. From the center of a whorl of 6 or 7 lanceolate leaves on fine stalks rise buds the size of an apple seed that open as precise white flowers. A few were in bloom, hovering over the carpet of pine needles. Wild flowers. Not only were they not placed there by the hand of man, no one has ever tinkered with them to make them bigger, showier, longer lasting, or their petals some other color. The wonder of it is that these exquisite indigenes are growing under a derelict Christmas tree plantation. My half-mile deep woods was once a maple beech forest. The whole region was part of the North Woods. Homesteaders farmed the light, sandy soils here. In my neighborhood, that worked for about a century. By the 1930s, a lot of soils began to blow. Pines became about the only crop that would grow in some places. Given time, other flora reappeared beneath them. Could star flowers be harbingers of the next North Woods wilderness? Now, cherries, maples, and beeches sprout up anywhere the sun can hit the ground. There's a population of wild lily of the valley, out back, too, and a wood thrush fluting every summer. Wilderness, according to one vernacular definition, is a place where human beings are on the menu, being large and unspoiled enough to harbor top carnivores. There's no official wilderness on Michigan's Lower Peninsula, but by the menu standard, the nearby Sleeping Bear Dunes National Lakeshore offers the possibility of being slain by a furtive cougar. The wildlife my land accommodates is common and harmless. Over the years, I've seen white-tailed deer, coyotes, foxes, skunks, coons, possums, a barred owl, wild turkeys, different warblers and flycatchers. Once in a great while, a sharp-shinned hawk will blast all the chickadees and nuthatches gathered at the bird feeder into invisibility. There have been snakes, frogs, and toads, moles, voles, mice, squirrels, and cottontails. Bat scat tells me I've got Chiroptera, but I don't know what kind. Excepting slugs, maggots, beetles, a pack of feral dogs, or a cannibal, there's nothing out there that could eat me. On my rambles, though, I'm always finding bones and strews of feathers, lots of different scats. Wild things eat each other all the time. On this recent ramble, two or three crows waltzing overhead were all the wildlife obvious. As time passes, the crows seem to be moving nearer to my house. I hear them cawing right outside my bedroom window in the mornings, see their silhouettes and shadows pass over throughout the day. Adaptable and pestiferous though they may be, I like crows. Being loath to waste food and wanting to be hospitable to crows, when my late cat became fickle about her diet, I would take the spurned, stinky orts, along with chicken bones or other fleshly offal, out to a mossy opening, cawing in my thick human accent, and depart. This evening, crows flapped above on reconnaissance. The one with the ragged primary feathers had a basso caw. The other two were mezzos. Seated under a tree, how conspicuous I must have been with my plain solid surfaces and upturned face. Not being armed or carrion, of what consequence could I be? A crow perched on top of a pine. I craned back to look for nests, couldn't see any. The perching one disappeared. The other two crows came and went. As the sun drifted lower, golden light beglamored the trees. The pines became more pungent in the heavy, cooling air. When I stood up, there was a wooden crack nearby. I looked behind me to see a flash of deer shanks fade into the deeper woods. Reluctantly, I headed for my writing studio. Passing through another opening in the woods, I noticed that a crow had followed me and was making casual passes overhead. I stopped and gazed, liking the moment very much. Both being sociable, wide-ranging generalists, that crow and I had a lot more in common than most animals. She was no Kirtland's warbler, and I'm no tarsier. The molten glory of the sunset washed every twig, cone, needle, and flake of bark. Treading on up the hill towards my studio, I reached an open stretch of the path and saw that silent crow still with me. She drew in her wings, and her whole body was a pulse. She stretched them and caught the sunset underneath, two quick copper flashes, then the black silhouette rowing through a slaty sky. By and by, the crow flapped off. I switched on the lamp in my writing shed. The crow came back. I stepped out for a minute, and that was that. A half dozen gulls ousted from the county landfill had glided past earlier, off to forage in some newly tilled field. Those gulls brought scrounging to mind. Uneasily, I wondered whether the encounter with the crow had not been an elective affinity, but a clever bird looking for a handout. I had thought of offering a snack, but didn't, deciding it would be wrong to accustom the crow to connect me with food. But had my earlier offerings done that, or had the crow been training me? As the magic of the encounter dissipated, I thought of the crow scenario in Peter Ward's good, grim Future Evolution. In one of the book's chapters, Ward, a paleontologist, projects a future 10 million years hence. The few generalist organisms that survived the current unpleasantness have long since founded new lineages. Their descendants occupy niches in all the altered landscapes. Ward lands a time traveler in a garbage dump. There he encounters scores of new species of snakes, rats, and pigs, all morphed for scavenging. Crows, too, have evolved along several paths, including top carnivore. Huge raptorial crows have become the post-Cenozoic lions, and a hapless Homo sapiens wandering through the landfill, their prey. Evolution is wild. All beings are implicated. none is left unchanged. Countless partners, countless dances. Yet the wildness of evolution or of the lithosphere might as well be an abstraction. As Gregory Bateson put it, extinction of the dinosaurs was trivial in galactic terms, but this is no comfort to them. We cannot care much about the inevitable survival of systems larger than our own ecology. In a wild cosmos, control, finally, is an impossibility. Death is wild, and among our own kind, at least, we try to control it. We expand the perimeter of civilization, hold the beasts at bay, lose sight of nature's ultimate truths, and become predators and prey to ourselves. The more individuals and societies strive to rule the wild, the fiercer the planet's revolts become. Yet, however deranged the race has become, not all humans have lost their love for the wholeness of life and things, the divine beauty of the universe, Robinson Jeffers wrote of. Diehard wilderness defenders are not about to quit fighting for it, regardless of the odds and the definitional niceties. Conservation biologists map out half wilderness for our future. Ecological restorationists sow the feral landscapes to come. They know that wildness is the preservation of the world. Everything alive grew on a wild stem. Star flowers are wild. White-tailed deer are wild. Crows are wild. And as long as the sun keeps shining, all our destinies remain in play. Sir, could you shove me a copy of that white book, please? Thank you. So, I don't know, I don't want to be too much in the ecological gloom and doom. It's hard to avoid, but there's always growth, there's always life, and there's always gardening. And I would like to read a passage about gardening from this book, Epicurean Simplicity, assuming I can find it quickly. There's a whole lot about bicycle riding in this book too, and I'm just not up for it yet. It scares me. Any more? Okay. Gardening. I've been a kind of a on-again, off-again gardener. You know, I feel sort of like it's a moral responsibility to garden and grow some of my own food, but I haven't really stuck with it enough to develop the chops, so mostly my gardening consists of helping starts commit suicide. Actually, the best garden I ever had was the year that my divorce was in process, and I really poured a lot of energy and amendments and everything else into that garden. And so this passage begins shortly after that. By harvest time that year, my mood had improved. The divorce was done, and I was having an affair with a contractor who was completing the detail work on the house. Harry was a deluxe guy, an Aikido practitioner, Zen student, beekeeper, and guitarist, accomplished in many genres. Altogether, a smart, funny, good-hearted man. For the couple of months when he was working around the place, we'd been having enjoyable conversations. By and by, one twig led to another. Our liaison, an outcome of attraction and propinquity, seemed only natural. And as autumn approached, it was my delight to feed Harry dishes prepared from the day's freshly picked vegetables. I might harvest a couple of cucumbers, a handful of bush beans, and two handfuls of potatoes, and cook the bounty forthwith, being careful not to steam the potatoes a second too long or to overseason the cucumber salad. The following spring, I began a coast-to-coast hegira as a roving bioregionalist, promoting my first book, attending conferences, and visiting old friends. The garden, neglected in my frequent absences, went to hell, as did the affair with Harry. When the next gardening season rolled around, I found I'd lost my zeal for the old garden site. Perhaps I'd tilt in a little too much spite. I also had to admit that, however historic, the location was not propitious. It was low-lying, shaded by increasingly by the growing pines, and the last place near the house to be freed of snow. Because what's underfoot here is not so much soil as sand, that dose of fertility that I had recruited from an old pig pen was quickly exhausted. For the next couple of years, I didn't have a garden. I kept telling myself that the thing to do would be to terrace the sunnier, southeast-facing slope in front of my studio. There, I could start anew and resume the topsoil building endeavor. In this scheme, I'd have garden beds handy to tend whenever the writing got impossible. During those years, I found myself traveling, often during spring and summer, as I worked on another book. The bold new beginning in a better location remained but a vision. After a while, there was a new man in my life. Tom enjoyed both gardening and cooking. Over at his place, he had a big garden, cunningly furnished with found art trellises, borders, and mulches made from materials that less frugal folk had discarded. For me to have a garden seemed redundant. I could work a bit in Tom's garden to earn a serving or two of fresh vegetables, do a little weeding or pick the beans and lettuce for our supper. After I'd been a migrant laborer at his place for a couple of years, Tom said he wanted me to have the fun of a garden of my own. That June, he announced that his garden was already overrun with plants. He sought a sunny venue where his surplus cucurbits and solanums could indulge their expansionist tendencies. He would plant some squash and tomatoes on my sandy studio slope with its southern exposure. In a station wagon, he hauled buckets of horse manure over to my place. He fertilized the little plot and then installed the half dozen or so plants he'd lovingly started. Now all I had to do was look after this kindly gift of a garden. After a week or so, Tom mentioned that he thought that shallow watering, which is what he had noticed me doing, causes vegetable roots to linger near the surface where they're likely to dry out. Deep watering in big soaks, he said, lures the roots down into the soil, sends them questing with gravity for the moisture at depth. A leaky bucket, he said, could be an economical means of such slow and steady drip irrigation. Shortly after receiving that advice, I was headed out to my writing studio to put my pert nose to the literary grindstone. Suddenly, I felt overpowered by an urge to do some deep watering. As a side benefit of my involvement with the local natural foods cooperative, I am the possessor of several 5-gallon white plastic buckets that once contained peanut butter and other bulk food items. I figured I could spare one for drip watering. As I pierced the bucket near the bottom with 5 closely spaced nail holes, it occurred to me that in many parts of the world, water vessels are often a family's most essential piece of household goods. To have an extra bucket to perforate seemed to me a form of wealth. From the faucet by the side of the house, I filled 2 other buckets. When Phil and I built the house, the drilling company down the road had sunk a 200-foot deep well and installed a submersible electric pump. A statewide utility supplies the energy to raise the water from such a depth. I turn the tap, and cold, clean, potable water gushes forth. This water came easy. Use it up, wear it out, make it do or do without is one old formula for material simplicity and non-consumerism. Lacking sufficient garden hose and being too cheap to buy any, I spent the afternoon hauling buckets of water from the tap to Tom's squash and tomato plantation. Water is heavy. Carrying the weight got me thinking about all the effort expended all around the world on hand-watered crops. Gaining sympathy with peasant women everywhere, I made it a discipline to carry two full 5-gallon buckets nonstop the 200 yards from the tap to the thirsty pumpkins. Carrying water pained my palms, felt as if it were dragging my arms out of their sockets and bore me down to the ground. When I put the buckets down, my arms would float up involuntarily as they do in that kid's trick after one has pressed outward on a door frame for a minute with the backs of the hands. When carrying water and chopping wood is not a choice but a necessity, it's toil that can break people down, bend them over for life. Members of the middle class might imagine that peasants would cultivate strength and fortitude along with crops and other bare necessities, but what if that's not so? What if that mandatory simplicity just leaves folks weary and aching all the time? It may be that humanity took a wrong turn with the invention of agriculture. There's probably no turning back, but forensic anthropologists now tell us that, contrary to popular belief, once crops were domesticated and could be stored, human health declined as settlements developed and human populations rose. Thinkers such as Paul Shepherd say that our psyches also took a wrong turn back then. In The Tender Carnivore and The Sacred Game, Shepherd argues that the domestication of organisms and civilization's misunderstanding of and alienation from nature are cause and effect. Domesticated plants and animals are a defaced, infantilized version of wild stocks. The pastoral misleads us as to the nature of nature, which is wild. Still, a woman's got to eat, and even Orrin Lyons, who's a pipe carrier for the Onondaga people and a great sage of our time, says that food comes from those who plant and grow it. My friend Tom Deering, who nearly always gets his buck, says that if for some apocalyptic reason we all revert to foraging, there will be one hunt and one gather. Having mused my way full circle from the old Stone Age to the new, I placed the perforated bucket at the first squash plant and filled it to the brim. The water sprinkled out at just the right rate of flow, filling the little well around the plant's stem without overspilling the berm. Eureka! Flushed with success, I was in my own personal Findhorn, bringing happiness and good wishes to vegetables along with precious water. These poor plants, long on sunshine, short on humus, they were attempting to grow in ground either stark or mangy with knapweed, bunchgrass, and sorrel. It would take a mighty power of wishing to make this improbable garden succeed. I tried another one this year, too. This time I now have neighbors who ranch alpacas, so I trucked wheelbarrow loads of alpaca dung over to the garden. And I think there may be a few potatoes out there waiting for me, but then, you know, events keep overtaking me in my gardening endeavor. Pretty hard to be a one-legged gardener, but I'm sure people have managed it. How are we doing on time?
You've been reading for about 35 minutes, so
okay.
10 minutes or so if you'd like.
Okie dokie.
10 minutes is great.
All right. Now let's see. What's a good one? This is my most recent book. It's a collection of essays that were published in various places, but hadn't been collected before. And it would be great if I could find something funny. I'm not always on a total bummer. Maybe what I'll do is read the title piece, Tough Little Beauties, which is about a population of dwarf lake iris on Beaver Island. And it was for commissioned for a book that, alas, never appeared, but it was going to be a commemoration of the Michigan Natural Areas anniversary. And so they invited various Michigan writers to sort of take a natural area from a menu. And I chose Beaver Island. When we think of rarity and value, precious stones, jewels whose glittering beauty is condensed and crystalline may come to mind. Jewels are scarce and close to indestructible, hence their worth. Fragility also can render things rare and precious. A rare thing is one of which there are few, although that rarity may once have been abundant, even common. Human activity has affected the rarity of many once common plants, animals, and kinds of natural communities. French Bay State Natural Area on Beaver Island in northern Lake Michigan has abundant arrays of the rare dwarf lake iris. From the iris, I learned that fragility is situational. Although the plant is regarded as a threatened species by both the state of Michigan and the federal government, these bright, beckoning, inch and a half tall irises are both fragile and not. They flower around Memorial Day. Then these pale lavender irises with white blazes leading to stubbly saffron beards look like a welcoming scatter of stars upon the conifer duff. Jade fans of scimitar sharp leaves outnumber the flowers and denote the iris rhizome's presence. The blossoms won't wait, and the iris won't grow just anywhere. It was both necessary and a rare pleasure at the end of May to take a break from another project to fly to Beaver Island to see the irises bloom. These threatened plants are tough enough to have endured through the years up near the Straits of Mackinac, tough enough to endure wind and ice and blowing sand, to survive under the snow, and to cope with the fluctuating lake levels and changing precipitation. They've occupied their niche, and it has conditioned them for millennia. In their natural habitat, dwarf lake iris seem plentiful. During their brief moment in the sun, they're certainly the showiest of wildflowers. On that day at French Bay, my companions and I noted plentiful swaths of iris leaves and flowers by the path that led down to the bay. We spotted them back under the low-slung cedar boughs in that shoreside forest where the light could angle through, and in places a little farther from the beach's edge, where a gap in the canopy might let the sunshine fall. The walk to French Bay takes you down from the level of ancient Lake Algonquin, which existed about 11,000 years before the present, toward today's Lake Michigan. We threaded a narrow trail down a 20-foot bluff, admiring the abundant jacks in the pulpit, wild sarsaparilla, Solomon seal, and the numerous delicate sedges, ferns, and mosses of the forest floor. Along the way to the shore were swampy, tea-colored ponds, their dark surfaces perfectly mirroring the enormous leaves of skunk cabbage. White birches shone among the gray trunks of beech, maple, hemlock, and their equally somber-barked associates. In this emerald realm, under the hardwood canopy, black-throated green warblers called zee-zee-zee-zoo-zee, and black and white warblers weeza-weeza-weeza, their songs mingling with those of peewees, wood thrushes, and countless others. Breeding season bird surveys on Beaver Island have found almost 90 bird species. When you arrive at French Bay, all the colors change. There's a long, bleached sweep of pebbly shore, an acid green, algae-rich slough, a sand and gravel bar exposed by falling lake levels. Shorebirds skitter on the bar, and tadpoles shimmy in the warm, soupy water left in the slough. Visible across Lake Michigan's deep-hued waters, other islands of this archipelago float, forested. More than once I've heard old-timers say that their folks thought the woods would never come to an end. Like most forested places in the Lake States, Beaver Island was cut over a few times. Sure enough, the trees have grown back, but with each cutting, some of the richness of the forest has been lost. It takes more than three or four kinds of trees, trout lilies, and trilliums to make a Great Lakes forest. It takes a rich and fitting community of wildflowers like the irises, violets, paligula, wild lily of the valley, and star flowers. It takes stumps and root wads and tip-ups, blowdowns, and widow makers. It takes fallen tree limbs and trunks crisscrossed like jack straws to structure the niches for all the animals necessary to the forest's flourishing. The habitat preferences of the many bird species can be as various as their songs and plumage, ranging from treetops to cavities and snags to quiet places on the forest floor. Logging, I'm going to skip a little bit ahead. Logging is drastic, but even light visitation can undermine the integrity of wild places. Spotted knapweed, a ruinous invasive species, was growing on the beach at French Bay. There are only a few knapweed plants there so far, but ecological invasions can begin with only a few alien organisms. Like other visitors, I may have carried in a few extraneous seeds on the soles of my shoes and served as another vector. The innocent human potential to damage nature is difficult to own. There's nothing natural about a crowd of tourists, however respectful and careful each one of them may be. It's a good thing there wasn't a well-marked trail to facilitate streams of visitors to French Bay. The dwarf lake iris aren't fragile, except that they could be quietly loved to death, or worse, annihilated by the clearing and soil disturbance that inevitably accompany lakeside construction. What is fragile, then, is the integrity of the habitat and its natural community as it has developed over time. Never-ending work in preserving and protecting places like French Bay, the once common places that have become rare, precious, and fragile, means that there may be a future for all those tough little beauties like the dwarf lake iris. The existence of French Bay and of Michigan's natural areas means that we as a people are showing respect for other life communities, showing the restraint that is a sign of decency. We can afford to let those places be as they are and protect their integrity. And this means that the future might just include a new abundance of sweet old beauties that passed through a perilous time of being threatened and rare. Thank you.
Thank you.
So now I will certainly entertain questions, or we can have a discussion. Yes. Yeah, I don't think there's been any moratorium on building and construction there. And even just, you know, a home site can change things a lot. But that was quite a wonderful trip. We were hosted by folks from the biological station up there, the Central Michigan University, I think, has got a biological station up there. So, yeah, it's a wonderful, wonderful place. They had, in addition to being there with writer and photographer friends, there was a whole passel of students kind of having their first experience in a place as untamed as Beaver Island, and making that all-important contact with some less trammeled nature.
Can you tell us about your work on Robert Swan?
Sure. I was asked to undertake work on a biography of Bob while he was still alive, and he died a few years after the thing got underway. Bob was a conscientious objector in World War II, which is a pretty, actually there were more of them than you'd imagine. There were He was a non-compliant CO, which meant that he didn't even accept, I mean, he didn't countenance the idea of a draft. So he didn't register for the draft, and therefore he was imprisoned for a couple of years. And there were 6,000 such young men at that time. So he was, you know, by nature, a very independent, conscientious, and although he would never sort of own his own courage, I mean, he was possessed of a great deal of courage, you know, that allowed him to do what he thought was necessary and right. What happened to him in prison was wonderful, actually. His partner of later years, Susan Witt, said that prison was his monastery and his university. He was incarcerated with a number of other COs, like COs, among them Bayard Rustin, the great strategist of the civil rights movement. Rustin was instrumental in educating Martin Luther King and the SCLC about the potency of nonviolent direct resistance. Anyway, so there was quite an extraordinary group of young men in these federal prisons, and a great educator, Arthur Morgan, who was at one time a president of Antioch University and a tremendous champion of the small community, offered a correspondence course on community to these men in prison. So Bob and his cohort spent a chunk of their 2 years reading about the cooperative movement, and they also, through reading Lewis Mumford, became completely aroused by Frank Lloyd Wright's architecture. I mean, it was just an incredibly fertile time for them. This exposure to ideas, you know, being part of a kindred, I don't want to dwell too much on the prison part of it, but I found it very, very interesting. And it nurtured his lifelong decentralism. When he emerged, he became, his bread labor was building and design. He married a woman who was a formidable peace activist herself, and so from the mid-40s to the early 70s, they were active participants in the peace movement and the civil rights movement, and they were practitioners of nonviolent direct action, meaning that they would try to obstruct what they considered to be wrongdoing by sit-ins or marches or fasts. That kind of thing. So a very, you know, rich, interesting couple of decades in the thick of the peace movement. And that kind of shaded through his involvement in the civil rights movement towards his development of an array of institutions for local economic development and regional economic, not to say sovereignty, but he saw that, you know, that economy is sort of the and one of the basic structures of society, and that economies can work to scatter resources and the community's wealth, or they can work to, you know, fold it back in to building communities. One of the first sort of big innovations he made was the development of the Community Land Trust, which is a nonviolent approach to land reform and to getting land out of the speculative market. And a land trust, the land is held by a not-for-profit corporation, and the corporation has a tripartite governance structure that consists of people who are living on the land, people from the community around the land who rightly should have some say in its use, and then experts who may, like landscape architects and lawyers and financial experts who can contribute to the governance of the land trust. And the way it works is that the trust owns the land and leases sites, heritable sites, to individuals. So people have equity in their houses or their developed orchards or that kind of thing, but they can't sell those at a profit. All the equity that you develop on a land trust has to be offered back to the land trust at replacement value rather than at a speculative profit. And this, the community land trust idea actually branched off into urban land trusts in a big way. But there are more, there are a scatter, a few dozen more rural, diverse land trusts, like the one that Bob and his partner Susan launched in the Southern Berkshires, which includes a residential sort of property where the Schumacher Society's headquarters are. It includes a historic farm that where actually the first CSA in America began, and also some low-cost housing units. So land trusts can comprise a lot of different kinds of properties, and the long-range goal is to secure affordable access to land for essentially productive purposes or basic needs like housing, affordable housing, or agriculture. Bob also helped craft an ingenious micro-loan program there that is sort of collateralized by depositors' passbooks. It's called the SHARE program, and it's, again, it's a membership thing. The thrust of all his work was to make the community's economy participatory and transparent so that, bankers could do their good and necessary skilled work, but the purpose of the SHARE program was to help individuals get very, with no credit records, get small productive loans. So first, they went to the community as a whole and said, there's a need for this kind of activity. And if you join SHARE, your membership costs $100. You put that $100 as a savings deposit in a local bank, and you give us the passbook. And that shoebox full of passbooks is the collateral for these small loans. Issuing of the loans was done not just by the bank, but also just by community members. So again, small, sort of local intelligence about a person who, one of the earliest instances was a horse logger who needed to buy, a second horse. A woman with a little knitting business, who wanted to buy a knitting machine. It was all about making productive loans, loans that would sponsor activity that would repay the loan. This has been going on in the developed world. I'm sure everybody's heard about the Grameen loan program. But so far as I know, these were independent developments. Although another fascinating thing about doing this work has been to learn how tremendously influential Gandhi and his disciples were on this generation of American dissenters. Gandhi's nonviolence really dawned on pacifists in America in the late 30s as a whole new day and a whole new possibility. And Gandhi's own economic approach, which was very much village-focused and aimed at self-reliance and sufficiency rather than excess, also influenced them greatly. So that thread of Gandhism sort of runs all the way through Bob's life and work. He was a lovely man, and he really had just an extraordinary gift for understanding the workings of economics and being able to imagine ways to, you know, change, to perform necessary role for a local economy to perform its necessary roles without disempowering or impoverishing the community that underwrites it. Yes. I think there's really a consensus has emerged on this, and it is, you know, total access to all means of birth control and family planning, maternal and child health care universally provided so that children live, and a high family size is not a result of trying to hedge one's needs against high infant mortality. And the education and economic empowerment of women. If women are educated, it's, you know, it's demonstrable. If women are educated and if they have a little bit of economic autonomy, they tend to want fewer children. And if those children can be healthy, that's everybody's a winner. So that really is sort of the only way to approach it, I think. And the thing that, you know, I came into the ecology movement on a concern for overpopulation. I was very influenced by the work of Paul Ehrlich, the population biologist and brilliant. Well, he's no mere polemicist, but he writes a good, strong case for it. And at that time, you know, he pointed out that we've totally accepted death control. You know, as we've incorporated that into our ethos, but we haven't complemented it with birth control. So, you know, more people live to reproductive age and reproduce as a result of death control, which nobody wants to repeal. So we just still need to institute just universal access to family planning and maternal child health care and women's education. Simple order, but, you know, it's humane. I mean, I don't see too many objections to that, but... Yes?
The issue with overpopulation that concerns me, or the argument of overpopulation concerns me, is that the first world uses it against the third world and says that you need to stop having children and stop having consumers, but one of us consumes entirely much more than them. So, and their ecological damage, and the reason that they can't, that the ecology can't support that population is because of our actions. Industrial processes and things like that. So I wonder if you could speak about that, because
sure.
It's used often, the overpopulation argument is used often, and it doesn't make sense because it's claiming that you need to, that we need to do all these remedies to the third world and stop them from having children when we're the things that need to stop.
Well, it's a little more complicated than that. I agree with you that the impact of people in industrialized societies is disproportionate and needs to be reduced drastically, not for global equity and also just, you know, to preserve the planet. However, Blackboard, but the Ehrlichs came up with a pretty handy formula for thinking about overpopulation, and its impact is a function of affluence multiplied by technology, multiplied by just numbers. So there are different variables that constitute the impact of population. This is not, certainly not to argue the point that the global North has battened on the South and has exported a terrible development model, and forced it on developing nations. I mean, that's what this whole, the trade regimes are all about, destroying subsistence agriculture and marketing, commodities out of relatively unspoiled places in the developed world. So that's, that's a great wrong that needs redress. However, I don't think that there's any place on the planet that's not overpopulated in a sense. Something like, 2/3 of the planet's surface has been affected by human action, and I'm trying to think, something like 40% of the planet's net, photosynthetic productivity is appropriated by human beings. I mean, that's a big, that's a global generalization, and your point's very important that we need to break these generalizations down. However, what is needed to do for overpopulation, I mean, my goodness, I think it would be great if we did all those things in the United States, if we had universal access to birth control, reproductive rights, health education. I mean, that has been rolled back in our country, let alone the rest of the world. So, but definitely consumerism is the death of the planet, and it's something that we're trying to keep the day of reckoning off in this society, with a lot of hopes for techno fixes and things like that. But we really, I believe, we're looking at a much more profound transformation of this society to a lot more direct involvement in producing our own basic needs and a lot less lavish use of energy, all of those things. So in a way, I mean, we in the global North need to be focusing on the issues here and be clear about the evils of consumerism, for lack of a better word. However, I don't think that's an argument against the necessity for population stabilization around the planet, because it really benefits the health of communities. Small family sizes work better for most concerned. Not satisfied?
Yeah, I agree.
Huh.
Because, I mean, they have large families to make it work.
Mm-hmm.
That's how it was in the past, that we had large families to make the farms work and to make,
yeah.
By telling them that they need to not have children, is telling them that they need to cut their support lines.
I don't hear that telling them what to do aspect of this conversation so far. I think the issue of when I hear you say telling the families, I mean, I share a concern. I think there are a lot of ethical problems with telling anybody what to do with their reproductive choices, but I think I agree that providing access to birth control and health education generally would have the effect of reducing population in a less coercive way.
The other thing is that the fossil fuels era has kind of underwritten this enormous expansion of human population, and it's coming to an end. So agricultural techno fixes are there won't be massive techno fixes coming through to feed people. It'll be more intense cultivation and perhaps different forms of social organization. Undoubtedly, I mean, women's liberation changes everything. I hope that the direction that we're pushed in by all these converging crises is towards greater egalitarianism and justice and liberation. Yes.
Well, this has nothing to do with anything political, but I've noticed that your writing style is very lyrical and almost pastoral in a way.
Mm-hmm.
But I also got the impression that there was a lot of narrative involved with the things you're talking about, which transcended the realm of your description and you kind of delved into a more narrative type path. And I was just wondering, where do you come up with the narration for these things that you're describing? Does it come from the object?
Wow, what a wonderful question. Thank you. I guess, the big narrative that I'm always writing about is, what are we doing? What are we doing and why are we doing it? What are we human beings doing? And so when that ongoing question sort of meets a natural situation, a situation of wild nature, it causes some sparks, I want to definitely describe nature and celebrate nature specifically and in detail, because that's where it's at. But all the sort of reading that I've ever done and thinkers I've ever paid attention to are with me in establishing a larger context for the natural object. Now, the other big arc, I guess, the narrative arc I'm trying to survive in is just the story of my own life. And so really there's a large element of memoir in all of my books. So this, Whatever Happened to Ecology was really written in part because I felt like in the movements of the 70s and 80s, I had a lot of experiences that I was seeing I'd been through a lot of fights about basic principles that were being argued again and again and again, and I wanted to maybe save people some time and trouble, although I think we all have to have our, debates to learn them. I also wanted to, sort of make my life a specimen life and not hold it up as a paragon, but to say, these are the kinds of difficulties that I collide with when I'm trying to walk my talk. These are not just the difficulties, but the delights. Does that?
Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome. Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much.